From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Russell Baker has described a newspaper reporter as someone who sits around in marble corridors waiting for important people to lie to him. On today's Fresh Air, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist talks about his own years as a reporter, the subject of his new memoir, The Good Times. Also, composer Danny Elfman gives us a sneak preview of the score he wrote for the new film, Batman. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at the roots of the blues revival of the mid-60s. And John Leonard reviews Boomerang, the new novel by Barry Hannah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When Russell Baker was growing up, his mother used to push him to make something of himself. He did. He started his career as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. After working his way up to London bureau chief and White House correspondent, he moved to the New York Times. 8 years later, in 1962, he got his own column, The Observer. His humorous takes on the issues of the day won him national recognition. In 1979, he received a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Baker won his second Pulitzer in 1982 for his memoir Growing Up, which told how he was shaped by the Depression and by a mother who planned to live out her ambitions through her son. Baker takes his story through the next stage of his life in his new book, The Good Times. It focuses on his years as a reporter from 1947 until 1962, when he became a columnist. I asked him which period of his life was easier to put into focus, his childhood or his early professional career.
It's much easier to deal with childhood. It's because you're so far removed from it. You can look at it with great detachment. It's something that happened a long time ago, and what you remember from it, you remember very clearly, with crystal clarity, but you don't remember a great deal. When I was writing about being a reporter in this book, I was dealing with materials which are swarming in my head. The real problem when you get dealing with that stage of your life is what to discard. You know, you have to leave out almost everything.
Mm-hmm. You have to maybe be more diplomatic, too, since you're
talking... To be more diplomatic?
Yeah, you're talking about colleagues here and newspapers and...
Of course. That's why, closer you get to the time you write a memoir to your own age, the more lies are built into it. I can be brutally honest with myself as I was at the age of 5, 10, 15. I can be pretty damned honest about the way I was at 25 to 35. But if you ask me about what happened last week, I'll tell you 3 or 4 lies. I have to. You know, it's too embarrassing to be absolutely honest about things that are that close to you.
Mm-hmm. When you entered newspaper writing, and this was in the late 1940s, you describe it as not only not a prestigious position, but you describe it as being in the social pit. Did that bother you or bother your mother, who was so ambitious on your behalf?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, my mother regarded newspaper work as honorable work because she'd had this cousin who became managing editor of the New York Times, a man named Edwin James. And she thought that being a newspaper man was a very important work. She thought it was more important than I thought it, as a matter of fact. It was, when I went into newspaper work, I was 22 years old, right out of college, and I had the young person's view of life, that what was worth doing was to do something artistic or creative, as they say these days. Terrible word. And I thought that would be writing novels. You know, I wanted to be a great novelist. Newspaper men were hacks to me. They wrote for money. And there's something dishonest about that, artistically dishonest. It lacked integrity. I wanted to be a great novelist. That was where integrity lay. Well, of course, the problem was that I couldn't write a novel. And worse than that, I wasn't even interested in writing a novel. I sat down and tried to write one. It bored me stiff. So I was one of those people who, they're quite common. You find people who want to be great writers, but they don't want to write. I wanted to be a great novelist, but I didn't want to write novels.
Did you love newspapers?
Did I love newspapers?
Yeah. Reading them, or?
Not at first. I got in the habit. Well, I'd always read newspapers since I was a kid. You know, I started reading the comics, and then I'd start reading the news. Used to live in New York and read the Journal American, a Hearst paper. It had wonderful columns, and there was wonderful crime coverage, and I loved crime coverage, particularly back in those days in the 1930s. There were a lot of executions. People were being fried regularly or hung. And I loved reading about the condemned man going to the chair, what he'd eaten for the last meal, and that whole grisly rigmarole.
It's funny that you like that so much, because when you were actually called on to cover a hanging and an electrocution, you did your damnedest to not go.
I certainly did. The thought of having to stand and sit in that penitentiary over in Baltimore and watch some guy drop right in front of my eyes with a rope around his neck was more than I could contemplate. But by that time, I'd been civilized, you see. As a child, you love violence, and something happens to you along the way. You get that civilized out of you.
Russell Baker is my guest, and he's just written a new memoir called The Good Times. It's a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize-winning earlier memoir called Growing Up. Your first work on the newspaper was covering the police beat, and then you ended up on Rewrite. You were surprised that the Rewrite man actually wrote everything in the newspaper, that the reporters didn't do it themselves. Once you were in the position of writing the stories that were phoned in, did you find yourself resorting to newspaper cliches or a lot, or doing your best to get around them and to be as original as possible?
Oh, at first, no. I think you learn all writing by imitating. You know, I really think that you read somebody you admire and you write like that. And then you read somebody else and try to write like that. You begin writing as a plagiarist. And once I started doing newspaper work, I tried to write the way I conceived newspaper men wrote. So I picked up all this newspaper argot. You know, the hailstones were always as big as golf balls. The rain was all not a rain, it was a deluge. A fire was not a big fire, it was a holocaust. Kids who stuck up cab drivers weren't kids who stuck up cab drivers, they were bandits. Everything was romanticized in this overstated, old-fashioned kind of newspaper lingo. And I've always had a gift for cliché, for aping aping bad English. It came naturally to me. I can say without boasting, because it's certainly nothing to boast about, that I was a very good police rewrite man.
It seems to me that as you became more and more advanced as a reporter, you became more and more aware of the fact that you weren't much interested in politics, government, or the national scene. Is that right?
Well, I'd been, you know, I had nothing but the best assignments. I got off the police rewrite in Baltimore. I was sent to London to be London bureau chief for the Baltimore Sun. I was brought back to be White House correspondent, and then the Times hired me, and I covered presidents, I covered the State Department, I covered the Senate. I ran around with all those guys running for president, Eisenhower, Kefauver, Adlai Stevenson, Jack Kennedy, Nixon. And I was away from home all the time. Meantime, I had three children and a family, and they were growing up without me. But my regular beat as old age began to grip me around the age of 37 was covering the Senate. And I was beginning to question the value of what I was doing. My father, one of the key events of my life, my father died when I was 5 years old. It had a tremendous impact on me. He was 33, died at 33. And I was covering a meeting of the Senate Armed Services Committee in the Senate one day. Closed meeting. We all, reporters, had to sit outside on the floor, wait for them to come out and posture or distort or lie outright about what had really gone on inside. And it was a long meeting, and I sat there and sat there. And I was 37 years old at that time, and I thought, see, here I am, 37 years old. When my father was 37, he'd been dead for 4 years. But in his lifetime, He had made something. He was a stonemason. He'd made something you could touch, that people could use, that you could see. And I thought, what am I making? I'm not making anything here. And I thought, instead, I'm sitting here wearing out my hams, waiting for somebody to come out and lie to me. And that was the stage at which I think I was finally grown up. That was the last moment of being young. And after that, it was a very quick transition out of reporting.
You're saying doesn't make complete sense to me, because, okay, maybe your father was making something more tangible, but you certainly made made an impact in reporting. I don't really understand why you needed as a writer. You know, why you needed something like more tangible.
I had become scared about reporting. I had lost my faith in reporting, that reporting was a worthy way for a grown man to spend his life, because I thought it's so difficult to get it right. And particularly when you get beyond police-type things. Sure, you can get the name of the dead person right and how many bullets are in the body. But when you get to covering the Senate, the questions are so subtle that often you don't even know what the right question is to ask. And the more I understood about reporting world events and national events and politics, the more it seemed to me that it was impossible ever to get it right. That all you could be was a transmission belt for deception.
Was it the deception war that was really bothering you?
Well, I didn't, you know, I had come into journalism and I've adapted to it believing that what was worthy about it was telling people what happened yesterday. I have sort of a school teacher's yen to make people understand, to see. And that's what I wanted to do in journalism. Other than if you couldn't do that, it wasn't worth doing, I thought. And I felt that I had discovered that you couldn't do it. Therefore, you know, I wasn't making something that was useful, as my father had done.
My favorite story about being deceived or not being spoken to straightly as a reporter was the Lyndon Johnson story. Well, I think this was maybe the first time you interviewed him. And he was telling you stuff, and you figured, well, he knows who you are, and so on. And he sends out a note to somebody during the interview.
Oh, yes. I've dined out on that story for years.
Oh, it's a great story, though. I think anybody who's ever interviewed anyone would relate to this story. Tell the story.
Well, by that time, I had worked with Lyndon Johnson for years. I'd known him since 1954, 55, because I'd been covering the Senate when he was Senate Majority Leader. I'd seen him in all modes and forms of dress. I'd seen him in his pajamas at dawn. I'd seen him drinking too much at midnight. And he'd become vice president by this time, so we're talking about 1961 or 62. And I was covering the Senate one day, and Johnson, who'd been forgotten, nobody knew he was alive, ran into me in the corridor one day and pulled me into his office and started talking. And, oh, he talked and talked and talked and talked. He talked for 45 minutes, nonstop, as only Johnson could. And at some point in this endless monologue, he wrote something on a piece of paper, buzzed his secretary in, gave her the paper. She went out to the next room. A few minutes later, she came back with another piece of paper. He looked at it, crumpled up, nodded, threw it away, and went on talking. And when I finally escaped, you know, I was on deadline, running down the hall, discovered I was being pursued by another reporter, a friend of mine, who'd been in the outer office when that Johnson's note came out. And he said, do you know what was on that note that Johnson sent out when you were in there? I said, no, what? He said, it said, who is this I'm talking to? Well, it was a wonderful lesson in humility, which newspaper men need more of, I suspect.
Yeah, and you felt that he wasn't talking to you, he was talking to the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Washington reporters need to keep that in mind. They often confuse themselves with the organization that they represent, but the politicians never do.
You spent the first part of your career at the Baltimore Sun and then moved over to the New York Times, first to cover the White House beat. And you didn't seem to like that very much, judging from your book, and it seemed that there were so many people covering everything from the Times, that there wasn't always enough work to do, and there were sometimes too many reporters on a story, you felt.
Yeah, but you must remember that when I came to the White House, I had been in London for a year and a half, 2 years, whatever. And I'd gone to London at 27 as a correspondent for The Sun, and they offered me the job covering the White House. Then I switched over to the Times. Well, it sounds glamorous. It's wonderful you're going to be the White House correspondent. You know, it's top of the world, Ma, right? Everybody wants to be White House correspondent. Well, I checked into the White House the first day over there, and it took me about 36 hours to realize I'd made one of the world's great mistakes. I had sacrificed London for the honor of sitting in this sealed room listening to White House correspondents snore. Absolutely nothing went on. You know, you were given press releases periodically, and you took them back to the office and typed them out. A copy boy could have done the work. But you had your name on page one every day. Well, that was my experience at The Sun. Scotty Reston came along, hired me to The Times, and promised I wouldn't have to. He would take me off the White House. I had to go up to New York first and worked in that enormous city room of the New York Times, where they had so many people that the city editor had a loudspeaker system. He summoned the staff to the city desk over a series of amplifiers hung through the city room. I felt utterly lost. And somebody said, don't be alarmed. People were sitting around playing bridge. There was a running bridge game. Other people were doing the crossword puzzle. It looked like people who hadn't done anything for weeks. And somebody said, the Times always likes to be well-staffed in case the Titanic sinks. They've got enough reporters to cover it. So I went back to Washington, and pretty soon Scotty Reston had me covering the White House again. There was no escaping Washington.
I want to talk with you about how you got out of reporting and into writing a column, but first we're going to take a short break. My guess is journalist and humorist Russell Baker, who's written a new memoir, which is called The Good Times. It's a sequel to Growing Up. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Russell Baker writes the Observer column in the New York Times, and he has a new memoir titled Good Times, which picks up where his Pulitzer Prize-winning earlier autobiography, Growing Up, left off. You went from reporting to writing a column at the New York Times. You were almost wooed away by the Baltimore Sun, but the Times made you a counteroffer to stay, and they offered you a column there. When you started writing the column, did you start writing it humorously at the very beginning?
No, I had no idea what it was going to be. I had never thought of writing a column that would be humorous, that anybody would call humorous. I incidentally still don't think of it as a humor column, but it certainly wasn't conceived in those terms. I really didn't have any clear idea what I was going to do, but I thought it was going to be a casual essay kind of column. A casual column, as they say, and what I was firm about was that the diction would be primarily an Anglo-Saxon kind of English rather than Latin English. For example, you know, I would say use instead of utilize. I would say do instead of implement. I would put it in the mother tongue, so to speak, because so much of the Times in those days was written, it sounded as though it had been written in Latin and translated directly into English. And I thought I would write it in simple English prose, very direct, and it would be casual. And that's what I did for several weeks. Just whatever came along in the news, I would comment on copying some of the style that I'd discovered E.B. White doing in the old Talk of the Town in the New Yorker. And after several weeks, Time Magazine's press section had a piece saying there is a humorist at the Times, and it turned out to be about me, and I was astonished, also a little appalled, because I hadn't thought I was doing humor. And I concluded finally that, well, anything that was in plain English at the Times in those days must seem funny. That's how I got that tag laid on me. But I wasn't interested in doing humor. In fact, if I'd told anybody at the Times in those days that this was going to be a humor column, they probably would have fired me.
Once you started writing the column, did you get out of the house very much? I mean, you used to be on a beat where you had to be out and reporting all the time.
Yeah, the hardest thing about going from reporting to a column is the discovery that as a columnist, if you have a fact, you're in trouble. A column is a reflection of a mind, that's all, of a mind that's confronted with certain data that everybody else is confronted with. Is it an interesting mind, a dull mind, an extraordinary mind, a weird mind? The column will reveal that. But it's not a business of conveying information. And when I first took it on, I couldn't get out of the habit of going to fires. You know, I'd go to the White House, I'd go to the Senate, I'd go to the State Department, wherever the story of the day was. I was there taking notes and coming back and trying to turn it into a column. And I had a good friend who sat across the aisle. Every once in a while, I'd show him one and say, "What do you think?" And he'd shake his head, "No." And he said, "It's not a column, it's reporting." So it was a terribly difficult transition. And of course, because in American journalism, you're trained to keep yourself, to keep your personality out of what you write, it's very difficult to get in the habit of suffusing whatever you're writing with your personality, which you must do to make a column successful. If the column doesn't express your personality or some aspect of it very forcefully, it won't succeed.
My guest is columnist Russell Baker, who's written a new memoir called The Good Times. I want to go back in time a little bit to a subject that you've written about in both of your memoirs, and that's the subject of your mother. In both of your books, you've written about her ambition for you to become something and for you to never be a quitter. How do you think that drive both helped and perhaps hurt you?
Well, that's a very old American thing. I guess even today you're supposed to make something of yourself, aren't you? That was my mother's message. If you work hard, you'll make something of yourself, apply yourself. You'll be somebody. You'll make something of yourself. Well, it gets translated very quickly into making a lot of money. That's commonly what happens because somebody said, William Hamilton, I think, said, in America, money is life's report card. How do you know you've made something of yourself if you don't have the money to show it? So I had been marinated in this approach to life. You had to make something of yourself. Sociologists would say these days I was intensely success-oriented. I pursued success with great zeal and vigor. And I was successful. In a way, this book is about being successful when young. And what happens at the end, what I discovered was that that day sitting in the Senate corridor, growing up, if you will, that being successful wasn't enough. There was more to it than that. And, you know, I thank God for my mother's help and insistence that I do make something of myself, because I didn't have much will to until she got behind me. But at the same time, it had given me a kind of tunneled vision view of life that wasn't entirely healthy, I think. And when I reached that stage, 36, 37, it was necessary to have another look at myself and see if there wasn't more to life than being successful.
And what did you find?
Well, I don't know. That's the next book. After success, what?
Well, do you know yet? I mean, will you find out when you write the book what the answer to that question is?
Of course. I mean, how do I know what I think if I haven't written it first?
You know?
Writing is thinking, you know.
By the time you're in your 30s, I guess, in your new book, you've become a pretty good drinker. Was that ever a problem for you?
No, I didn't have alcoholism?
Mm-hmm.
No. I drank because it was what you did in to be a newspaper man when I came into the business. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, and I didn't drink every day, but, you know, I drank on every occasion when you had time to drink. I was afraid to drink on the job, never drank on the job, because I discovered very quickly if you drank, you couldn't write. You know, you thought you were writing brilliantly, and then you saw it the next day, and you discovered you'd made a fool of yourself. Mm. But drinking was what, it went with the territory in those days. You're probably too young to remember the old movies with Lee Tracy and Adolph Manju, all those movies made in the 30s about the romance and glamour of city rooms, all based on the front page, of course. And the strong feature of all of them were the cigarettes were going and the booze was flowing. So I had to do those things to qualify as a reporter.
I still
like to drink. I tend to favor wine more expensive than I can afford these days.
Did your mother ever feel that there were consequences that her ambitions had that she hadn't counted on? For instance, when her health started failing, you were, I believe, in Europe or something on assignment. I mean, that your success made it difficult for you to spend as much time with her as she probably would have liked.
Oh, I don't think that bothered her, no. No, you know, of course, my mother lived to be a very old age. She, relatively old, it doesn't seem as old as it used to. She died at 87. This book ends with her funeral, in fact. She was 87 by that time and had been hopelessly senile for 6 years. She collapsed at about 80, and her mind went out. It's as though all the circuits of her brain broke down simultaneously. And but to that time, she had never indicated that she wanted to spend more time with me. It wasn't that that she wanted. What she wanted was something to talk about to the neighbors, you know. It's so typical. It's like a bad story. She would bore the neighbors to death with tales of her son, the columnist or the White House correspondent or whatever. But when she saw me, it was always, this isn't good enough. You know, if you work at this White House job, you might really make something of yourself. If you work at this column, you might make something of yourself. So she was enjoying that success that I was having, and didn't especially want to want me around the house or underfoot by any means.
Mm-hmm. Ever still have dreams about writing that novel?
No, I have no interest in writing fiction. I discovered journalism shown me that the world that's right in front of my eyes is so much more interesting and complex than any my imagination is capable of creating that it would be foolish for me to try fiction. I just don't have the gift for it. Fiction's a special gift and requires a special kind of commitment that I have no interest. I just couldn't do that.
Russell Baker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Baker has written a new memoir. It's called The Good Times, and it's published by William Morrow. It's the sequel to his first memoir, which was called Growing Up and won a Pulitzer Prize. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. To rock fans, Danny Elfman is the guitarist and singer for the group Oingo Boingo, but to movie fans, he's the composer of the film scores for Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Big Top Pee-wee. Coming up, Danny Elfman previews his music for the new movie, Batman. Also, rock historian Ed Ward traces the source of the blues revival that swept the rock world in the mid-60s. And book critic John Leonard reviews Boomerang, Barry Hanna's new novel set in Faulkner South. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush made good on his promise today to veto a bill that would have increased the minimum wage. Details from NPR's Mara Liasson.
The president has been threatening to veto the bill for weeks, and today, on a flight from the Grand Tetons National Park to Lincoln, Nebraska, he did it, saying that an increase in the minimum wage from $3.35 an hour to $4.55 an hour over 3 years would stifle job opportunities. Immediately after his veto message was delivered to Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives agreed to try to override it on Wednesday. But an override is considered unlikely, because neither the House nor the Senate approved the new minimum wage law by a two-thirds majority, the margin needed to kill a veto. If an override attempt fails, House Democrats are reportedly ready to try to craft another minimum wage bill more acceptable to the president. President Bush had proposed a minimum wage no higher than $4.25 an hour, along with a new training wage, which could be paid to all new employees, regardless of their age or experience, for the first 6 months on the job. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Bush today began a campaign for his Clean Air Initiative, unveiled yesterday. The president used as a backdrop the towering Grand Teton Mountains, where he told an audience of 1,000 residents and tourists that nature needs our help. Despite disputes among energy, mining, chemical, and environmental groups about what to do, Bush said there's one thing everyone agrees on: we need action, and we need it now. Chinese authorities are using the country's state-run media in a nationwide manhunt for top student leaders. The students are wanted for crimes allegedly committed in connection with China's pro-democracy movement. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Over and over, state-run radio and television are broadcasting the names and photographs of 21 students who were on the most wanted list. Authorities have issued warrants for the 21 as part of a nationwide roundup of political activists. In the past 10 days, some 800 people have been arrested. Authorities are searching for others, not only students, but anyone who had a prominent role in the past 2 months of pro-democracy demonstrations. In addition to names and photos, the state-run media are giving citizens a telephone number to call with any information on suspects. And all day long, newscasters keep up the barrage of propaganda, painting demonstrators as enemies of the people and of the Communist Party. In Beijing, this is Vicky O'Hara.
The Justice Department today confirmed that it has not launched an investigation of Democratic Congressman William Gray. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh's office issued a statement vindicating Gray late last night. The department reportedly is looking into the possibility of a ghost employee on Gray's staff. The investigation was first reported by CBS News, which caused Gray and other House members to strongly protest to Thornburgh about information concerning the probe being leaked to the news media. Thornburgh's statement said Gray is not the target of this investigation, and he and his office have been fully cooperative. The six-term congressman from Philadelphia is making a bid to become assistant Democratic leader and had been considered the front-runner in a three-man race. Authorities in the Central Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan continue to find victims of recent clashes between rival Muslim sects. Crews searching gutted houses in the region now say that 90 people were killed and nearly 1,000 injured when Uzbeks attacked minority Meskhetians, a Turkish people deported to Central Asia 40 years ago by Joseph Stalin. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 15 points to close at 2503.54. Declines led advances 2-1 on volume of 165 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered about the origin of heavy metal, rock and roll historian Ed Ward says you should listen to the flashy guitarist who led the blues revival in the 1960s. The revival also rekindled the careers of some old Chicago bluesmen, Muddy Waters and Helen Wolfe, and brought the younger crowd, Junior Wells, Buddy Guy, and Albert Collins, into bigger markets.
Back in 1963, everybody knew that blues was a type of music played by old black guys on acoustic guitars, and that if you were white and sincere, you could play the blues too. Of course, by 1963, it had been a while since any of the great electric bluesmen like Muddy Waters or Otis Rush had had a hit, so the poor, deluded college students in their folk music societies could be forgiven for thinking this. But there were other white musicians who had found that their love of rock and roll led them to electric blues, both here and in England. And when the Rolling Stones came out, playing some of this stuff, not very well, these people thought, but with some feeling, it was a kick in the pants. Now, folk music had been very successful commercially, and the Rolling Stones were up there with the Beatles, at least in England, so some U.S. labels started fishing around for some white blues players. Paul Butterfield Blues Band, an integrated group from the south side of Chicago, the university, and the ghetto, was signed to Elektra, a folk label, early in 1965, but their raw power scared the folkies at the label, and this early session with Michael Bloomfield on piano was shelved after it was recorded. Elektra's competition, Vanguard, had no such compunctions and found what they were looking for in the Gaslight, one of Bob Dylan's favorite hangouts.
You love me, darling. Please call me on the phone sometime. Yeah, yeah, you say you love me, darling. Please call me on the phone sometime.
John Hammond was the son of the famous record executive of the same name. And for this recording, his hand-picked band included Charlie Musselwhite, a Chicagoan, on harmonica, Mark Levon Helm from Arkansas on drums, and Jamie Robert Robertson and Eric Garth Hudson, Canadians, on guitar and organ, respectively. This was just a pickup group for the record, though. Hammond's usual backup was Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, featuring a weird young black guitarist who played left-handed and called himself Jimmy James because Jimi Hendrix didn't sound quite right. Still, he was a fine blues guitarist.
Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming in love, the deep blue sea. I have all you pretty women fishing after me, showing up after me.
In England, the scene was a little different. Blues had been a part of the jazz scene there since the mid-50s, thanks to Alexis Korner, a tireless propagandizer for electric and acoustic blues. More artistically solid than pop music in the minds of musicians, blues was a calling, like the priesthood, and when a guitarist appeared who could play it, they called him God. Clapton had quit the Yardbirds because he didn't want to play pop music, and here we hear him with a pickup band that included Jack Bruce and Stevie Winwood. Shortly after this session, Clapton joined John Mayall's Blues Breakers, who attempted to bring relatively authentic blues to the pop charts, and succeeded in Britain anyway. thing was, over here, record companies were scared of this music, believe it or not. Electra recorded Butterfield, Clapton, and several others, but never released the recordings until the Newport Folk Festival had been galvanized by Bob Dylan, with the Butterfield Band backing him in his first Electric appearance. Only then, when the Butterfield Band had released its first album, did record companies make the first feeble attempts. Goldberg Miller Blues Band, featuring Barry Goldberg and Steve Miller, for instance, wasn't exactly what the fans wanted. Not even the highly commercial New York-based Blues Project sold many records. The blues revival of the mid-60s was mainly important because so many people started playing guitar as a result of it, and because, with virtuosos like Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, Mike Bloomfield, and Johnny Winter inspiring them, they began to push the boundaries of rock and roll even further.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. When Danny Elfman wrote his first film score, he couldn't read music. Yet that score for Pee-wee's Big Adventure turned into one of the more memorable film scores of the 80s. Elfman has become one of the top young composers in Hollywood. He also wrote the scores for Big Top Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, and Scrooged. Elfman has a parallel rock career as the leader of the band Oingo Boingo. The most hyped film of the summer is Batman. You may have read that Prince wrote songs for it, but Danny Elfman wrote the score. And in part two of our interview, we get a preview. Elfman, you know that when people come to see Batman that they're already going to have music in mind because of the old Batman TV theme. Did you want to kind of ignore that and write something that didn't pay homage or acknowledge that theme at all?
No homage whatsoever. There's not really too much homage to the television show in the movie, so there was no reason to do it in the music.
Before writing the theme, did you have to sit down with the director, Tim Burton, and decide, you know, what kind of tone the theme should have?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What did you talk about? What did you decide on?
We basically, when we sit down and it's what you call spotting a movie, you talk about the entire movie as a whole and you talk about different variations that you're going to want the theme to take. We needed something that was very simple so it could state itself in very few notes and still become Batman's identity, and that could play both in a more gothic, romantic sense or in a more kind of an up-tempo march.
Yeah, when did you start becoming aware of good film music?
When I was about 12, 13, and I was growing up on all those wonderful science fictions in the 60s, many of them which had Bernard Herrmann scores, although I didn't know it, who it was really until later. I knew that it had a big effect on me. Journey to the Center of the Earth, Jason and the Argonauts, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is still one of my favorite scores. That's where I really started becoming aware of film music. And then as a teenager, I got heavily into other composers, and especially Fellini films with Nina Rota's music.
I think really some of the best orchestral music of the 20th century has been written for the movies. Did you ever feel like where else could you get to write the kind of music you're writing, and where else would it get performed?
In my case, yeah. Nowhere else in any way, shape, or form, at least not during my lifetime.
Has writing film music given you the opportunity to express certain musical interests of yours that wouldn't be of interest at all to a rock audience? I'm thinking a lot of people have
I don't think it would be of any interest to a rock audience.
Yeah, well, I think some people even have musical tastes that they'd be almost embarrassed to admit to a rock audience because it would be considered square or something.
Well, everything I write for orchestra is square by rock and roll standards. I don't give a damn what anybody thinks. I love the challenge, and I love working in film, and I also love doing rock and playing with the band. So what a rock and roll audience may or may not think of my work for film, I really could care less if it works for the film. And vice versa. I don't care what people who are into my music or into film music in general think of what I do when I'm with Oingo Boingo.
Do you hear any connection at all between your rock work with Oingo Boingo and your film scores?
No. Mm-hmm. No. In fact, I think that's probably why I've gotten successful as a film composer coming from rock and roll. I think that's the mistake most rock and rollers make when they get a chance to score films, is they don't leave what they've done behind them and approach it completely fresh as a completely new medium. And I fortunately elected on my first film there to let it all go and go back to my early roots as a child before I even ever heard rock and roll.
Which was what?
When I used to listen to films, the types mm-hmm. of films that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was, if there's anything in retrospect that I did right, it was approaching my first film orchestrally with no rock and roll attitude towards it at all.
Have you ever had to take an assignment that you thought was kind of middle of the road? You knew you wouldn't be excited by the kinds of music the director wanted, but you took it on anyways.
Well, I've never taken a film where I couldn't write the type of music that I wanted to write, but I've written music for some really silly films that I knew were not going to be extremely inspirational and that I wouldn't be able to write any very inspired music to, but I was interested in doing them because I want to learn about all kinds of film and film music. And it's much harder to write behind a scene where people are talking or telling jokes or something than it is to write behind a scene where a plane is flying in the air over vast landscapes, or somebody is looking off into the distance, or you're on a montage where there's no dialogue at all. That's the easy stuff. So I did movies like Back to School and some stuff like that, that certainly the music I wrote for it isn't as wild or interesting, I think, as Beetlejuice or Pee-wee or Batman or any of those movies. But it was a challenge for me to deal with a movie that had almost all dialogue and all talking, so I was interested in doing it at that time. I'm not interested in doing those anymore.
What new challenges did writing the score for the Batman movie have for you?
Well, it was my first action adventure epic type of a score, so it was real difficult in that sense. And it was also a lot of music, 75 minutes of score. Beetlejuice only had maybe 48 minutes, which is about average for a film. And also I was dealing with it in a much more simple way than I would most movies. I tried to take an approach that was almost more going towards Max Steiner's type of approach to movies in the 40s, of dealing with many variations on a single simple theme.
Mm-hmm. Did writing the music for Batman also bring you back to some of the movies that you really loved as a kid, like Journey to the Center of the Earth?
Oh, yeah.
Big scores.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I don't pay homage to Neil Hefti for writing the Batman television theme, I definitely paid homage to Karl Orff in one place, and to Bernard Herrmann, specifically to Journey to the Center of the Earth in another scene, and to Max Steiner and a couple of other scenes. So, yeah, there's I'm often and frequently paying homage to other composers that I love, and it's fun to do that, especially if it's the kind of music that I love writing and I loved listening to in the past.
Your best-known scores, like the Pee-wee films and Beetlejuice, are very playful in tone, and I think the Batman score sounds more suspense-adventure-oriented.
Oh, it's definitely got more of a darker element, although there's some of the wildest music I've ever written in Batman. There's a chase cue with the Batmobile that I think is by far the craziest piece of orchestral music I've ever played. God knows the members of the orchestra were sweating while they were playing it.
Danny Elfman wrote the score for the new film Batman. It opens nationally on June 23rd. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We'll be watching China again. We'll take a rickshaw tour of Tiananmen Square today and find out about Fang Lezhe, the dissident who has taken refuge in the American embassy, what he's doing there and what he stands for. Congressman Bill Gray of Philadelphia, the Justice Department has said it is not investigating him. We'll take a look at some of the troubles that Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles is having. And, of course, the president is out west, still talking about clean air. We'll be in taking a look at Argentina. The new president is going to report for work early. Gorbachev is in Bonn. And we have Paul McCartney's new album.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Barry Hanna's first novel, Geronimo Rex, won the Penn Faulkner Award. Hanna draws on his own life in his novels and short stories, but now he goes a step further in Boomerang. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Barry Hanna is a child of William Faulkner's Southern Gothic. If you care about Faulkner and miss him, you're better off reading Hanna than Frederick Carl. Carl's brand new 1,000-page biography is an enormous smog of Faulkner facts, most of them irrelevant. Whereas Hanna's novels and stories are full of Faulkner's ghosts, they howl at Faulkner's moons, his Thomas Hardy sort of fatalism, the crushing weight he felt of history and original sin. They try to talk their way out of Faulkner's suffering traps. As if language had teeth, they chew off their own paws. Hanna lives as Faulkner did in Oxford, Mississippi, and he's done his best, as Faulkner did, to destroy himself by booze. And in Boomerang, he even makes fun of Faulkner. His parody is both hilarious and obscene, but he seems also to gag on the tongue in his cheek. Father killing is serious business. Boomerang can't decide whether to be fiction or autobiography. It's a brilliant fidget. Memory messes with itself. The writer sails a boomerang over the hedge of his southern boyhood. It returns to the grown-up Hanna, bringing with it all that's happened in between, the good deeds and the cruelty. We meet real people, named out loud, writers like Willie Morris, Norman Mailer, Jim Harrison, Alex Haley, and Tom McGuane. And real people thinly disguised, like Eudora Welty, unkindly burlesqued, I don't know why, and I resent it, as Mona Neary. And characters I take to be fictitious, like Yelverston, whose son is murdered and whose revenge is the surprise twist of Hanna's plot, a moral boomerang. Meanwhile, frying squirrels or shooting snakes, riding his Harley or a hobby horse, blowing trumpets or cocaine, beating a drum and his third wife, Hanna fumes and rages. I seem to be talking about nothing but war, and the threat of calamity, he says. The calamity is that we get only 75 years to know everything, and that we knew more by our guts when we were young than we do with all these books and years and children behind us. Once upon a time, this Barry Hanna was, quote, tiny but sincere. Later on, they put him in a nut house. Because of drinking and shooting, he explains. I had a nasty laugh then, and I was a roaring drunk with weapons in my hand. I thought I was enormously sensitive and a hero, but I was scaring hell out of everybody I loved. Nevertheless, he insists, I love my father with the deepest fathoms. And we are all so loaded up with what our good mothers did in the past that we walk through life like darlings. These days, he tells us, he's a father again, and he's given up smoking, and he's kind to animals, and he listens to Bach. He promises to love his children on the heroic, redemptive plane of his character Yelverston, a lifetime deal. We've heard these promises before from other male American novelists, like John Cheever in Bullet Park and Joseph Heller in Something Happened, and I'm not sure I believe Hanna. He's still waving his guns around. He still scares hell out of me. But so did Faulkner. Both of them caused the mind to creep as well as the flesh.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Boomerang by Barry Hanna. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Philip Dick's 1981 autobiography, Valis, was an instant hit in the science fiction community. His best-known work, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, was the basis of the movie Blade Runner. Now Valis has been adapted into an opera. On the next Fresh Air, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews composer Todd Machover's score, which premieres in America later this week at MIT's Media Lab in Boston. And in what's become a Flag Day tradition on Fresh Air, we replay language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg's decoding of the convoluted syntax of our national anthem. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Linda Martin and Hillary Goldhammer. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.